Hi, this is Lisa Henderson, and welcome to the Daring Parenting Program on Hoodsprayed FM. People have asked me, what makes a daring parent? Well, in my mind, a daring parent is one who's willing to admit we don't know everything there is to know about kids and parenting. Number two, to be willing to ask your children questions. And number three, to be able to listen to their answers without judgment, which in the teenage years can definitely be a challenge. So we're on every Thursday morning at 10, every Tuesday night at 7, and we welcome any feedback. If you've got questions, you want to send them anonymously, you can do that to a private message at Facebook for Daring Parenting or for Hoodsprayed FM group. Let's get started. Today, we have a guest. He's a returning guest on Daring Parenting, and he's an American psychiatrist. His name is Dr. Stephen Pries. And he did a lot of work with adolescents in psychiatry. But he's also written a book and has a video about self and self-esteem called Is There a Hole in Your Bucket? And it's one of the things that we've been asked a lot about for questions. How do you build a child's self-esteem? And what constitutes self-esteem?
Brains, talent, and riches. I've had people come into my office with one or two of those blessings, and sometimes all four of those blessings, and not have self-esteem. Now, what's wrong with this picture? How can you have those blessings, and those are the ones that are given to you, you don't even have to earn them, and not have self-esteem? Well, as I wondered about it, what I came up with is something like this. You can't have self-esteem if you don't first have a sense of self. And you can't have a sense of self if you don't have good boundaries. Now, emotional boundaries define a person. Boundaries of a country also define a country. If you cross the boundary from Georgia to Tennessee, unless you see the sign, you may not even know that you're in a different place. However, if you go from here to Mexico, the language changes, the currency changes, they will inspect your bags, the customs changes, you're in a different place. The example here is that it's important for you to know that you're a different individual person by having good boundaries. You don't want to just be a yes man and say yes to everything that comes along and goes in one ear and out the other. You don't want to be easily persuaded. You want to be able to maintain your own safety because you know what's good or bad for you. You need to have judgment. And all of that depends on having good boundaries. Another example is like having a house that has no locks on the doors or windows. It's not very safe. People can come and go as they wish. They may eat your food, sleep in your bed, rummage through your closets or drawers. It's certainly not comfortable, much less safe. Someone may come into that house that's unprotected. They may make up the bed, paint the walls, wash the dishes, fix the meals, and in fact do what seems to be something that you would want. But the problem is you don't get any credit. You can't demonstrate that you controlled what happened. This is the problem, of course, that poor little rich kids have. You know, their parents are so famous or so powerful that nobody can believe that anything that they did was something that they did on their own. They just figured that their parents got it for them. So they have an individuality problem.
Is it really that important to have good boundaries and to be able to say no? Or if you know someone makes you angry and they've crossed a boundary?
Boundaries not only protect you and keep the bad out. Boundaries also keep the good in. And if you don't have good boundaries, it's like having a hole in your bucket. It doesn't matter what you pour in the top. Doesn't matter whether it's beauty, brains, talent, or riches. You pour honey and gold in the top. If it's got a hole in the bottom of the bucket, then it's just going to run out the bottom. You can be with someone that loves you and compliments you and adores you, and then they leave, and 15 minutes later, if you don't have good boundaries, you're feeling empty again. So it's imperative that you understand boundaries and that you have good boundaries. Also, it's important that in therapy, you can't convince a depressed person that they're okay. You can't convince them of all their blessings and that they ought to have self-esteem because it'll just run out the bottom when they leave. What you have to do in therapy is make sure that you teach them how to say no, mind, set limits, have judgment, so that you repair their boundaries, and then once they have good boundaries and have a sense of self, Self-esteem is usually the easy part.
Well, can you give us an example of poor boundaries?
Examples are a student who is so self-conscious because of lousy boundaries, they're never late. They're always on time. I had a young man like this, and he was just so self-conscious of the stares of others because it seemed invasive to him that he was always punctual. But it wasn't because he was had a good routine, was in control. It was because instead he was so nervous about being stared at. Another woman that I treated was both a student and working, and at school, because she was so bright, people loved it when she raised her hand to make a comment or ask a question, because they knew something good was going to come out of it, and they probably learned something. And so she could see the appreciation in their eyes, and her self-esteem at school was terrific. But at work, the same brains made her very competitive, and she was always doing more than everybody else, and they didn't like her at work. Well, she could also appreciate the animosity that she picked up on at work, but because she had lousy boundaries, she then let that determine her self-esteem there, and so she was always on an emotional roller coaster, feeling good and feeling bad. Obviously, what we had to do in treatment was to help her with her boundaries. Public speaking is one of the world's greatest fears. People would say that that comes in before dying, even. And again, it's because if you have a lot of people staring at you, if you don't have good boundaries, the fear is that you have had your boundaries violated and you've lost your sense of self, which is almost like death.
So it seems like boundaries are necessary to have a healthy relationship. So what drives someone to create an unconscious, unhealthy relationship with poor boundaries?
Individuality, a drive. I can't shrink it out of you. It comes right after survival. After you have taken care of air, water, food, and maybe shelter, then you want to be an individual, and that individuality as a drive comes long before lust and love and togetherness and all those good mushy feelings. You've got to have individuality first. If you don't establish your boundaries and have a sense of self or individuality consciously by saying for space and saying no in mind and setting limits, then you will do it unconsciously. Now, the way that you do it unconsciously is with several primitive mechanisms, because after all, this is a primitive drive. The most primitive of these, of course, is anger. Whatever else anger does, the message is, get away from me. So if you have fused with somebody else because of your lousy boundaries, then you might pick a fight in order to get them to go away. Now you've restored your individuality because you're alone. Another mechanism after anger is fear or self-consciousness. You might decide that that person is dangerous, or your unconscious might tell you that they're not safe, or you may just become embarrassed by them because of the way they hold their fork. You'll fault find in a beginning relationship if you have lousy boundaries, because the closer you get, the more you feel you're losing your sense of self, and you have to figure out a way either to push them away. Fear will make you run away. A third way is depression. Depression is kind of like your unconscious saying, why don't we tell him that he's worthless and no good, and then maybe he'll go home and pull the covers over his head. He'll isolate. Well, that is a characteristic of depression, and whatever else depression has done in the most primitive way, it has shut out the world. You have reestablished your sense of self. All of these mechanisms, however, at a very high price. You're alone, and you're lonely.
What about relationships where one person has no boundaries?
You remember amoeba in high school, the little single-celled animals that had no cell wall, no boundary? If two of them came together, for all intents and purposes, one of them just disappeared. One of them lost its individuality, and the other lost its relationship, because you have to have two people to have a relationship. As opposed to paramecium, if you remember those, the little hard-cell-walled animals with the cilia, they, no matter how close they got under the microscope, were always separate. You could always tell them apart. And so the point is here is that if you have good boundaries, then you can stay together in a relationship because it won't cost you your sense of self. If you have lousy boundaries, then you're liable to be on one of these yo-yo relationships where you get together, get intense, and then get apart, because you have to reestablish your sense of self. Well, okay, so you have established your boundaries, and you know what they are, and you're trying to relate to people, and make sure that you set limits. And after all, we take our lesson here from children. When a child learns how to say no, then we know it's developing a sense of self. It has some judgment there that's different from the outside. And mine means that it's even taking possession of that sense of self. You can play with those toys over there, but this teddy bear and this blanket are mine. And then, of course, as we get older, we set other limits and take possession of our bodies and decide, you know, who has the permission to touch us or hold us or not.
If we know all this, why aren't relationships easy? It seems like they should be.
The answer is that closeness generates intensity. The principle here is that intensity of feeling changes how you think. The prototype example, of course, is panic. Panic is a feeling that is so intense, it not only changes how you're thinking, it'll stop your thinking. A bomb goes off, people run into the fire. See a wreck up ahead in panic, plow right into it, as opposed to keeping your head and putting on the brakes and steering around the wreck. The fire alarm goes off, people may show up in the street with a handful of coat hangers instead of their wallet. Panic disables your thinking entirely. Now, on the emotional speedometer that I want you to learn here today also, the top end is panic. Short of that is confusion, which is probably the worst feeling that people have if they somewhere between panic and confusion, because it's just an awful feeling of being out of control and not being able to think clearly enough to get back in control. Short of confusion is ambivalence. You've at least clarified that there are two issues, but you literally can't make up your mind. You can't get off dead center and decide which way you're going to go. Short of ambivalence is disabling anxiety. You know what you need to do. You've got it down to a single decision. You may have even done it before, but you can't make yourself do it. You know, you can't make yourself ask that person to marry you, or tell that person you're leaving them, or ask for a raise. These things that are very intense, and even though you know what you need to do, you can't make yourself do it. Short of that is just sort of normal anxiety, things that we have to do that make us anxious, but we're able to summon up our courage and make ourselves do it, and after all, we decided it wasn't that hard. We're able to overcome that. Now, going off the speedometer on the other end is a whole other talk, but the point is you always try to have a certain level of intensity, but not too much. And closeness generates intensity. In our society, this is also true. Adolescents can talk for hours on the telephone, but you put them face-to-face at a dance, and they can't talk to each other at all. We all like a little bit of eustress, coined by Hans Selye, the researcher in stress. There is a certain amount of intensity that we all like, but occasionally we like a vacation where things are calmer. But then we also go to the movies and see Arnold Schwarzenegger do intense things. Other ways of decreasing intensity are intuitive medications like cigarettes and alcohol and drugs, also food. Carbohydrates do soothe. I mean, you can't find a cracker in the dorm at exam time because everybody's intense and they're munching while they're cramming. And so we do try to increase intensity one way at the same time that the exam is increasing it the other. By the same token, we build heroes up until it gets too intense and we tear them down. Power is another example of where the country has a collective, or the world even, has a collective unconscious that doesn't like too much intensity. So you need to understand that intensity crashes your boundaries. Closeness generates intensity. Other unintended ways of crashing your boundaries and having closeness, so many of us now have cell phones, as well as advertising on the radio, the TV, the billboards. It's coming at us from everywhere, and it's much more intense than it used to be. So there are all kinds of ways in society now that really crash all our boundaries and make our preservation of our boundaries and sense of self harder and harder to do. In treating couples, I will teach a couple that is in the middle of therapy that I'm trying to have understand about what intensity does to their relationship. If they're going to go on vacation, to look at their watch when they both close the car door and measure literally how much time passed before they either had an argument, had to get quiet, and feel like they had to get away. It's closeness generating intensity. There was the story of the engaged couple that was engaged for 7 years, and then they got married and divorced in a month. When they both had their own apartment, didn't matter how much they stayed together, the illusion of the apartments provided a sense of separateness and individuality, and they had accidentally measured what they tolerated for 7 years and were stable. But the minute they got closer by moving in together and getting married, it was too close. They couldn't stand it. They regressed turned into people that neither one of them fell in love with, and they had to get away. I also had couples who failed in couples counseling, went on to get a divorce, but because they got divorced, began to treat each other with more dignity and respect. Because of that, got close again, and so what I tell them was, you know, for heaven's sakes, don't get married again. But they had accidentally measured the closeness that was stable for them. So in intensity, remember to look at your emotional speedometer of panic, confusion, ambivalence, anxiety. Another example that I give people is if you're driving, it starts to rain, and it gets raining so hard that even your wipers are on high, you literally can't see, you stop. If you're able to, you may get over to the side of the road, but you certainly don't keep going. When someone is confused and not thinking clearly, for heaven's sakes, don't make a decision, because it's just going to be a flip of the coin as to whether or not they were correct. Learn how to hold still in a crisis.
Can you explain to us more about children and intensity?
Margaret Mahler and other researchers have laid out a wonderful developmental path for how children develop. Another way of understanding the continuum of human development is to understand that it is a progressive ability to perceive reality. The more we perceive reality, the greater the more intense it is. And so our maturation is a growth process of being able to deal with greater and greater intensity, hopefully to where you get to be a president or a general or a CEO, because you can think with millions of dollars and billions of lives or billions of lives and billions of dollars on the line, but you can think clear with intensity looking at you. Intensity changes how you think and act. Because intensity does change how you think. Of course, it changes how you act, and closeness generates that intensity. But you don't have to feel good to do good. You just have to do what you have to do. So how do you manage to have closeness if you've established boundaries? You know how to deal with intensity because of those boundaries, but you don't want to give up your boundaries in order to get close. How do you manage to be close and intimate? Well, I've had people come to me from other therapies where somebody said, tear down your walls and let's get close. You never tear down your walls, because closeness and vulnerability are not synonymous. The whole thing that allows people to be close, not that they tear down their walls, they put a door in their wall. That's my analogy that I use to help people understand that if somebody approaches you, then you then are in control of how close you will let them be. If you're going somewhere on an airplane and the person next to you starts up a conversation, but you'd rather read, you don't have to respond. You don't have to look up from your book. It may seem a little rude, but they'll get the message. The door is closed. Leave me alone. On the other hand, you may choose to be a little bit more polite. Don't say anything except fine, or yes, or no, or well. But one word answers, so that the message is you're polite, but beyond that, you're not open. Beyond that, you may discuss where you're going and what you're doing and open the door a little bit and peek into each other's lives. Or, of course, if you want to be intimate, you fling the door open and you can say and do anything you want. But even after moments of intimacy, you close the door. However quickly or fast or slowly, you close the door. You always have the ability, with that analogy of mine, to reestablish your sense of privacy and dignity. Even in marriages where you've been married for 20 years, you still close the door when you go to the bathroom. I mean, some things are just private. You reestablish your privacy and your dignity, and whether you want to be open or not is how you feel at the moment. And you make that decision right then and right there, so that you preserve your sense of individuality, privacy, and dignity by putting a door in your wall. The true measure of closeness is openness and honesty, not good feelings.
All right, so you've given us a real clear picture of boundaries and good boundaries. What's the payoff?
Well, okay, you established boundaries to protect your sense of self, preserve your self-esteem. You have healthy relationships. So once you've established that sense of self, and you're maintaining good relationships with good boundaries, what happens? With good boundaries, you then, as in step four of the of AA or any other anonymous group, support group, you then can take an inventory. No sense taking inventory before you've established boundaries, because that's going to change. It's going to be in flux. It's going to come and go. But once you've established your boundaries, then you take an inventory. And this is a common time in treatment. After I've helped somebody establish boundaries, where they will tend to get depressed. And the reason they get depressed is because they can see what's inside those boundaries that they own and that they don't like and that they have to get to work changing. They also may then recognize what is not within those boundaries or walls that needs to be there, and where self-improvement is now the goal. With good boundaries, there's still going to be accidents, tornadoes, traumas. Things are still going to happen. And so you have to learn that what comes at you, whether it's trauma or whether it's just criticism, do you make it the center of your emotional living room? Do you put it in the corner of a filing cabinet to be considered later? Or do you put that criticism out on the stoop with the rest of the trash? With boundaries comes clarity. I've had so many patients, as they establish their boundaries, be able to make decisions about things that they could not make decisions about when they came into treatment. The black and white got to be more and more, and the gray areas of their life got to be less and less. Now, that doesn't mean it got easier. Simple is not often easy. Stair steps to the top of the mountain may be simple, but they're not easy. So, but they did get clarity. And remember, this is the mind's job, clarity. Not correctness, clarity.
So we've gotten information in the first part of Daring Parenting about good boundaries, how to get them, how it creates clarity. And coming up, we're going to find out more ways that good boundaries help you have a healthy intensity. In other words, as human beings, we like a little intensity. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Stephen Preece on Daring Parenting on Hoodsprayed FM.